And good afternoon. My name is Rob Daniels, and welcome to Visions in Sound. Well, this week's show is another one of the many composer features that I do. However, in this case, it also coincides with a score feature as well. Well, the year is 1975, and the Prime Minister of Canada is Pierre Trudeau. In January, product labeling using the metric system is introduced. The CN Tower in Toronto is completed. The Soviet Atlantic Fishing Fleet is banned from Canadian ports due to overfishing. And the SS Edmund Fitzgerald sinks on November 10th of that year. The top films of 1975 were Jaws, The Rocky Horror Picture Show, Dog Day Afternoon, The Other Side of the Mountain, Tommy, and many others, including the feature I'll be doing today. The disaster film got its start with the earliest being the 1901 film Fire. The 1930 film San Francisco is about the earthquake, and When Worlds Collide from 1951 brought science fiction into the mix. Now, disaster films enjoyed their heyday in the 1970s with 1970 with Airport, 1972's The Poseidon Adventure, and 1974's The Towering Inferno. Now, it would only stand to reason that historical disasters would also become part of this as well. Well, The Hindenburg from 1975 hit screens on December 25th of that year. Directed by Robert Wise, the film was starred George C. Scott as Colonel Franz Ritter, who tries to piece together the details of a plot to blow up the giant airship. The cast also includes Charles Durning, Burgess Meredith, William Atherton, and Anne Bancroft, among many, many others. Now, David Shire, a composer on this film, would compose the music for Hindenburg, and he did a fantastic job, and you'll get a chance to hear that today. Now, I did have the great opportunity to speak with David about his score to Hindenburg, and well, among, like I said, among other things, and here is part one of that interview that I did with David Shire.
Let's start with what is your musical background?
My musical background?
Mm-hmm.
My father was a pianist, top pianist, and band leader in Buffalo, society band leader, you know, weddings, bar mitzvahs, all mm-hmm. that stuff, cocktail piano, and he taught piano during the day and played his gigs at night. I guess my first musical experience was on his knee sitting at the piano and him showing me things. He started showing me chords and harmonies, and really my nursery rhymes that I heard in the house all day long were show music, which in those days was the same as pop music.
Mm-hmm.
Then I studied piano privately in Buffalo, starting at age 8 or 9 in there, and playing when I was old enough in the lounges and in his band. And then at Yale, I had a jazz group. I had a jazz group during high school in Buffalo that played at dances, and then another one at Yale where I had a double major in English and music.
Right.
Wrote some shows there, met my theater collaborator, lifelong, Richard Maltby. We wrote two shows there. I accompanied the Freshman Glee Club. My jazz combo played all over the, you know, Eastern College circuit for dances, fraternity parties, sorority parties, proms, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That brings me up to New York.
Okay. So what inspired you to write film and film music?
Well, I always loved film music. Coming out of a light music background, so to speak, mm-hmm. film music reached me before the more austere classics did. And even the classical music that I loved was the inspiration for a lot of early film music, you know, W.C. Tchaikovsky, Ravel, Gershwin, really straddling both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to write theater music, but I also hoped I would do film someday. I have kept that split focus all through my life. Ironically, the people mostly on the East Coast who are fans of my theater work wonder why I waste my time doing film work. And on the West Coast, the film people wonder why I would want to spend time that I could be spending scoring movies working in a dinosaur niche like the theater. But that's just the way I'm made.
Okay. So how did you first come to work on the film Hindenburg?
I was, when I started my film career, most of my work was at Universal. I started doing television there, fifth or sixth year of the Virginian, things like that. And then I graduated to series television that I initiated rather than taking over someone else's show, like on McLeod or Sarge. And then that led to bad features, and then bad features led to good features. And one of the first good features I got at Universal was the Hindenburg for Robert Wise, who was based at Universal. And I can't remember the specifics, except I had done a few pictures, and I guess I was recommended to him, and he knew of my work from previous work. Had a successful first meeting with him, and was suddenly working on the Hindenburg.
Okay. So what inspired your approach to the score?
For the main title and the cues that are derived from it, I don't know exactly how I fell into it, but Richard Strauss and the four last songs in particular inspired me and became kind of a model of the kind of harmony and orchestration that was indigenous to that, or that was associated with that period, pre-war Germany. Strauss being a German composer, but I liked the what the music and that harmony seemed to depict to me. It was a lightness combined with a heaviness, a lightness combined with a kind of overblown hugeness, in the best sense.
Right.
Wagner was a little too much the one side for me, but Strauss kind of straddled that perfectly. Music that soared and that uplifted, and yet at the same time was very big, very thick. So it was kind of an audio correlative, a musical correlative of the Hindenburg itself. And my original conception for the main title was the piece of music that's there, where the melody is played on a trumpet, was originally recorded with a wordless soprano singing that melody as an arioso, wordless aria. Bob thought that was a really interesting idea, and we were happy with it when we recorded it. And then at a preview, some executive at Universal said, "That title song, where are the lyrics?" And that led to a movement to not do that, which was hugely disappointing to me, because I thought it really was unique and really fresh and historically accurate and just the right emotional and dramatic tone. So we wound up with the ridiculous situation, seeing that we couldn't call an 80-piece orchestra back in, of overdubbing a solo trumpet and a track of the whole rest of the orchestra that was stripping the soprano off and putting the trumpet on. And I never was happy with the way it sounded. Trumpet sounds compressed to me and like he's not really part of the orchestra. And it was very disappointing. But I guess people who only know the version that's there are happy with it. It was modeled after one of the Strauss four last songs.
All right. So, how involved did Robert Wise become in your music for Hindenburg?
I would say it was kind of average involvement, average healthy good involvement with a director, with a composer. He wasn't about to tell me, you know, what kind of music he wanted. We discussed the film in various places, and then I usually go home and write themes and take pot shots and come in and play them on the piano, which I'm sure I did. And he approved the themes and the approach. We, I think, agreed it would be a large orchestra and a full-blown movie score. But I think he just wanted the score to heighten the drama, to move things along, and the usual things that a score can do for a movie. But he I don't remember him as meddling much with detail at all. We changed some things at the recording session, but nothing major. The only major change I can remember is jettisoning the soprano and having to jerry-build that main title again.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, scoring has changed over the past 32 years since you did Hindenburg. But give us an indication of how you actually, let's say, how you would work on the main title back in 75, or you probably did it earlier than that. So would you start with the score page and then kind of go from there?
First, I did would always do piano sketch or, you know, piano composing of that song,
mm-hmm.
play it for Bob, get his approval, and then I remember getting the orchestration of the Strauss Four Last Songs so that I could break it down and study to make it my orchestration of my piece authentic. I had originally tried to get another orchestrator because I didn't think I could handle that mm-hmm. in the time I had, but he wasn't available, and he said, oh, hell, he said, you're a good orchestrator, do it yourself. So I holed up and did it myself, and it was a good exercise. Turned out to be fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of timeline were you given to compose the music for Hindenburg?
Well, it's so long ago that it's hard to remember, but as I remember that I wasn't rushed, and yet I couldn't smell the roses, you know. It was, and usually for a picture that size, 6 weeks to 2 months was about what you were given. That seemed about right.
So where did the idea for There's a Lot to Be Said for the Führer come from? Was that your idea, or was it and how closely did you work with?
They wanted a song
mm-hmm.
for the See, this is where my theater experience came in handy.
Okay.
Bob said, you know, either read it in the script or he told me that there was, or saw it for the first time, that there was a scene in which, well, no, it hadn't been shot, so I couldn't have seen it. I had to get it from the script. That there was a scene in which this performer, or two performers it wound up, did a satirical song about the Führer in the lounge
mm-hmm.
with German officers present, specifically to tick them off and show how they felt about Nazi aggression. I said to Bob, well, you know, a very close friend of mine in New York is Ed Kleban, who's I think would be the perfect theater composer for this job. When did Chorus Line open? 78?
Something like that, yeah.
I think Chorus Line had not opened, so Ed had not become famous. But he had done a lot of theater work, and I thought he'd be perfect for the kind of language and theatrical sensibility that was necessary to write this song for this very specific purpose. So Bob said, fine, and Ed and I wrote the song, and we played it for him, and he liked it, and taught it to Peter Donat. And it was shot.
Have you gotten much feedback about the song over the years?
No, hardly anybody knows it. I mean, the picture didn't do that well. You know, it wasn't. I think they hoped it would be like Poseidon Adventure or Towering Inferno. You know, another great high-grossing disaster movie. And I think you can correct me, but let me know. But it didn't do that well. Did it?
I am not quite sure on that one.
Well,
I mean, I
don't think it did it as well as they expected. It's funny, people, until his score was reissued, nobody has really talked to me about the Hindenburg score very much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was only available on 33.
Right.
And after 33s went away, I don't think anybody, you know, collected it that much.
Right.
Now I get the sense that buffs are buffs who didn't know about it are kind of rediscovering it, and I'm very grateful that they have a chance to.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to it for the first time in must be 10, 15, 20 years when I got the CD last week, and I was quite surprised. pleasantly surprised with, you know, how good it sounded. Mm-hmm. I am not one who keeps revisiting my old works and playing them at night. I'm too busy on the stuff I'm doing currently to kind of revel in the past. But it, I've had both experiences, going back to something I composed a long time ago that I thought was wonderful and finding out that it wasn't that wonderful. And this kind of experience is much more pleasant, going back to something that I wasn't sure, you know, what it would sound like now, and being very proud of it.
Okay, so where did the idea of a reissue come from?
Intrada.
Okay.
I think they've been trying for a long time. Various of my scores that weren't re-releasable like this seem to be easier to get now. The lawyers were tougher then, or I guess after a certain number of years they realized that they don't have to protect it, and it's stupid to do that, and no harm is certainly going to come from allowing it to be re-released, and they might make a few pennies.
Were you surprised that somebody wanted to re-release Hindenburg?
Well, Entrada does that kind of thing, and mm-hmm. I half figured, half hoped that someday some of my earlier, more important things would start getting out that in CD form. Farewell, My Lovely was reissued. It had a soundtrack recording on 33, and I think quite a while ago, 4 or 5, maybe even longer than that, years ago, it was released on CD, which was great. And then things like The Conversation, which never had any soundtrack album, when the DVD came out, we were able to get the Stripe from Walter Murch, and that made a CD possible, and they were able to clear the rights. And Max Dugan just came out, which never had a recording. And Pelham came out, which never had a recording at the time. So it's taken a little time for whatever to catch up with my stuff, but that's better than not having it caught up with at all. Mm-hmm. I'm delighted.
All right. So how involved were you with the re-release
of Hindenburg?
Yes.
Just saying, how nice. go ahead. And the liner notes were already written because I had written them for the original release.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have to do anything. With Max Dugan, I had to get, and with Zodiac, which is just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, those two recently, I did liner notes because those were new releases.
Mm-hmm.
And got involved in the producing in terms of the sequencing and selection. But Hindenburg was really already done.
Right.
And we'll have a little bit more from David in just a little bit. But you're listening to Visions and Sound on CKMS 100.3 FM Radio Waterloo. If you are interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on Visions and Sound, you can contact me here at the station at 884-CKMS. It's 884-2567, or you can try me online at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. Well, when I first watched Hindenburg, I was surprised at how sparse, actually, the music was throughout the entire film. It was really kind of an interesting way of scoring the film. I really, really enjoyed the way it was done. The film itself is quite suspenseful, considering, you know, it was done almost 32 years ago. What am I talking about? And it's an amazing film. I just was really impressed with the special effects, the music, the acting. George C. Scott, I mean, has he done a bad movie? Well, Firestarter, but that's another story. Anyway, so, like I said, this release of the Hindenburg actually comes from Entrada. Now, for those of you that aren't familiar with Entrada is actually a mail-order online label that you can get some amazing music from. And David touched a little bit on, you know, Farewell My Lovely and Max Dugan Returns and you know, that kind of score off there. But there are so many other scores from them, just some amazing stuff. Now, Hindenburg is actually limited to a release of 3,000. So it's a special release, and I'm very happy to have one in my hands. Thank you, David. And so I'm looking at it here, and it's, like I said, presentation is amazing on this, and Entrada does a very, very excellent job on their releases. I'm just going to read for you a little bit from the liner notes here. These are done by Jeff Bond now, and Jeff Bond is a regular contributor to Hollywood Reporter and has been an executive for Film Score Monthly, which is, you know, where this, it's an online site that you can also get a lot of music from as well. But they release their own stuff as well. But Entrada releases this one. So this is just a little bit of the liner notes from the Hindenburg. So, arriving near the end of the disaster movie cycle that had begun in the early 1970s with Airport and the Poseidon Adventure, Robert Wise's 1975 thriller The Hindenburg was also one of a handful of films, including the latter Midway, that combined the disaster movie formula, big name stars in peril courtesy of big budget special effects, with a historical perspective. The 1937 explosion and crash of the German Zeppelin Hindenburg had long been one of the most spectacular and horrific transportation disasters of the 20th century. And the live radio broadcast of the event and later dissemination of filmed footage of the disaster as it happened in the movie newsreels made the catastrophe one of the first mass media events and one whose impact would not be equaled until years later. The Hindenburg explosion effectively ended the short-lived era of airships, when cigar-shaped vehicles the size of ocean liners plied the airways, an outlandish, fanciful image perfectly suited to film. The Hindenburg story, in fact, had all the proper ingredients for the disaster film recipe: human hubris and folly in an over-ambitious Zeppelin program, which was being pushed by the Nazi Party for its effectiveness as propaganda. The U.S. had its own naval airship program at the time, but no passenger vessels. Dramatic conflict between Nazi and SS officers, the Zeppelin's crew and civilian passengers, and fire and explosions at the story's climax. In fact, the ocean liner-sized airship, full of big-name stars cruising through the air toward a fiery climax, the Hindenburg, played out like a combination of Airport, the Poseidon Adventure, and the Towering Inferno. Of course, none of that famous trio of disaster movies was based on historical events. In adapting Michael Mooney's novel, Wise and screenwriters Nelson Gidding and Richard Levinson, and William Link, rather, had to mix fictional characters and conjectural plot elements with historical characters and facts. Most of the characters of the film were based on real people, but their names are changed. Captain Ernst Lehman, Captain Max Pruss, Joseph Spa, Edward Douglas, Ludwig Knorr, Hugo Eckner, and Joseph Goebbels are depicted with their names intact. Many of the other characters are shown either involved in or investigating a conspiracy to blow up the giant airship are somewhat fictionalized. George C. Scott plays Colonel Franz Ritter, a quintessential good German officer who begins to piece together the details for the plot as he hobnobs with the upper-class guests on the airship. Roy Tynes is the bad German counterpart, an SS officer whose ruthless methods of interrogation come close to unveiling the plan despite Ritter's disgust. The actual culprit is an airman, Karl Borth. Oh, sorry if I ruined it for those that haven't seen the film, played by William Atherton, who is secretly a part of the German resistance movement. The passengers are a cross-section of American and German social types, including the Countess Ursula, Anne Bancroft, with whom Scott's character had a former romantic relationship, a rather romantic attachment, boozy and cynical businessman Edward Douglas, Gig Young, who two card cheats played by Burgess Meredith, and I hope I won't screw up this name too much, René Abergonos, circus performer Joe Spahn by Robert Carey, who's probably best known for playing Le Beau on the Hogan's Heroes, and entertainer Reed Channing, Peter Donat, who embraces the Nazi Party, embarrasses the Nazi Party members on board with a satirical music number. Well, I'll get to I'll get to the score. I mean, here I am talking about the film, The Hindenburg, and you actually haven't heard any of the score yet. So, without any further ado, here is a little bit of David Shire's score to The Hindenburg from 1975. Have a listen for this main title after the newsreel prologue with the trumpet in replacing the single vocal that originally was to be heard.
The Hindenburg is coming again. That's what all the excitement is about. The pride of Germany is due here on the morning of May 6. During the 1937 season, the giant airship is scheduled to make 18 round trips from Frankfurt to Lakehurst, New Jersey. Just 150 years ago, the Montgolfier brothers, two Frenchmen, made the first controlled flight in a hot air balloon. This rockabye baby is perking along with a new gas, hydrogen. In the gay 90s, ballooning really got off the ground. By the early 1900s, everyone agreed that an airship should be shaped like a cigar. Alberto Santos Dumont, a young Brazilian in Paris, achieved a major breakthrough when he hooked a two-cylinder gasoline motor to the basket. Next came the semi-rigid airship with a light metal frame. Bigger and better airships, all of them air-conditioned, continued to pop up before the World War. This time, a retired German army officer known as the crazy old Count von Zeppelin flew a 400-foot sausage equipped with two marine motors for 20 miles. The Count and a young associate, Dr. Hugo Eckner, founded the world's first air passenger line. In 1924, the Zeppelin Company built an airship for the U.S. Navy, the LZ-126, rechristened the Los Angeles. Until last year, the Graf Zeppelin was considered the marvel of the age. Since 1928, she has carried 13,000 passengers over a million miles without a single mishap. But then, at the Zeppelin Company works in Friedrichshafen, German genius created the airship supreme, the Hindenburg. Her vast cathedral-like hull, almost 3 football fields long, is an intricate web spun from more than 10 miles of duraluminum girders. 15 stories high, it houses 16 giant cells containing over 7 million cubic feet of hydrogen, which lifts her 242 tons of luxury into the clouds. She is the climax of man's dream to conquer the air, the new queen of the skies.
Thank you.
and welcome back to Visions and Sound. My name is Ram Daniels, and I'm presenting a special presentation of the recently released score, or re-release, actually, in this case, the score to Hindenburg. The original Hindenburg release was done on an LP in 33. Back, several years ago, we'll say on that one. And probably out there somewhere for record collectors if you're interested. But they, like I said, they've just recently released Hindenburg on CD. And if you're interested, you can go to the Intrada website. That is Intrada, I-N-T-R-A-D-A, or Intrada.com. And that way you'll be able to pick up this limited edition. I believe there are a few left, I'll say that much anyway. And like I said, what you're hearing is an amazing score. And like I said, just fantastic stuff. Anyway, if you're interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on Visions and Sound, you can contact me here at the station at 884-CKMS. That's 884-2567. You can also try me online at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. And I'll get back to you as soon as I possibly can. Also, if you're interested in a track listing of either today's program or any program I will do, any program I've done, rather, or will do in the future, by all means, you can send a request to that same email address. Well, welcome back to Visions and Sound, as I am presenting the score to the film The Hindenburg by composer David Shire. Now, the real Hindenburg was a German Zeppelin, and along with its sister ship, the Graf Zeppelin II, was the largest aircraft ever built. The Hindenburg was built in 1935 with a new all duraluminum design. It was truly visually striking ship of the air at 245 meters, about 804 feet long, and 41 meters, 135 feet in diameter. The longer than three Boeing 747s placed end to end, longer than four Goodyear blimps end to end, and only 24 meters or 78 feet shorter than the Titanic. It was originally equipped with the cabins for 50 passengers and a crew complement of 61. The Hindenburg was originally intended to be filled with helium, but a U.S. military embargo on helium led the Germans to modify the design of the ship to use the flammable hydrogen as lift gas. If you've ever watched, and I'm just taking a little side note here, if you've ever watched the show, what's the name of the show now? I'll think of it afterwards. Mythbusters. They actually did an experiment on with the Hindenburg and showed how it might have actually the accident might have actually happened. It's a very fascinating episode. If you ever get a chance to see it, I highly recommend it. It's very, very cool because they actually were able to essentially reproduce the Hindenburg accident. It was kind of nifty to watch. Well, Germany had an extensive experience with hydrogen as lifting gas. Hydrogen-related fire accidents had never occurred on civilian Zeppelins. The switch to helium, or from helium to hydrogen, did not cause much alarm. The Hindenburg was named after Paul von Hindenburg, not the crazy Baron von Hindenburg, as it's said in the newsreel. He was the president of Germany who knows if he's crazy or not, anyway. The president of Germany from 1925 to 1934. It is interesting to note that the Hindenburg was almost named the Hitler. However, the Zeppelin company was well known as being anti-Nazi. Hitler had wanted the airship named after him. But to prevent this, the company quickly named it after Paul von Hindenburg, the late German war hero, president, and non-Nazi. Here is part two of the interview that I did with David Shire, and I will follow that with some more music from the Hindenburg, as well as the song There's a Lot to be Said About the Fuhrer, a lot to be said for the Fuhrer in this case. So I'll be back in just a little bit.
So what do you remember as being the most rewarding part of working on the score to Hindenburg?
Well, I hadn't had that much big orchestra opportunities, and I think that was quite sure that was the biggest orchestra to date that I had had, and I always wanted to do a big full-blown score like that, and here at last was an opportunity, And it was thrilling to have that 75 or 80 piece orchestra at Universal and get to write for it and get to conduct it. And to be working on a picture which gave me a lot of good opportunities to write interesting, intelligent music. You know, some pictures are more like brain surgery, where you work very small and precise, and, you know, your friends say, where was the music? But this was something where music could really run with certain moments, and that's always a lot of fun to do, satisfying.
So how would a score that you write today differ from one you wrote, let's make a comparison. How does Zodiac, how does that compare, or how does that differ from Hindenburg, from writing Hindenburg?
Quite a bit. Hindenburg, just in terms of style, Zodiac is much more textural and low-key than the music for Hindenburg. David Fincher does not like the music to get too prominent, push too hard. He likes it to do what he feels it should be doing, and I think for the tone of his movies, he's absolutely right. Anything with too high a melodic profile that I presented to him, was rejected for that reason, and I came to see the wisdom of that. Instead of a big, you know, multi-instrument symphonic score, it was a big orchestra, 55, but it was all strings except three instruments. It was a big string orchestra, symphonic string orchestra, but just solo piano, solo trumpet in a few places, very, very sparse, and a French horn in one cue and a guitar in another cue, and that was about it. Technically, was the hugest difference. I mean, I could get a picture tomorrow that would require a score similar to the Hindenburg. Mm-hmm. Or I could get one tomorrow where they want one piano and want it to sound like The Conversation. All the styles exist concurrently, and depending on whose movie you see, whether it's Spielberg with a big Johnny Williams score, or Clint Eastwood with a one piano, one finger melody. Mm-hmm. Depends on the picture and the director and what they want. But technically, the difference between Hindenburg and now is huge. I was only in the same room with David Fincher twice, on two occasions, in the whole 3 months I worked on the movie.
Wow.
His alter ego, the sound designer named Ren Kleiss, on whom he relies heavily for musical decisions and helping him make up his mind about things and running the logistics of the score creation and the score recording and the score mixing, is his alter ego and was the go-between that I worked with much more in person. But even with him, except for the 3 or 4 days we recorded the score at Skywalker, I was rarely in the same city with him. What made this all possible was a wonderful system called PIX, P-I-X, which is a computer networking service for filmmakers, where if you are patched into the network and have your password, the film at any point in its development is available to you. The editor keeps putting up the most finished cut to date, and then if you're working on the score, you can do your synth demos and put them right up online, sync to the picture, and they have them in California instantly. I'm in New York. Ren was in L.A. or in San Francisco. David Fincher was in New Orleans or in L.A. because he started shooting his next picture.
Mm-hmm.
And at the scoring session, he was in L.A. We were in outside of San Francisco. But we were able to send finished recorded takes to him instantly, and he'd type his notes right on the PIC system. There's a way you can type your notes right below the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And we would do subsequent takes where he'd say, make the trumpet a little louder, or Can that be a little faster, you know? So it was all of this virtual conferencing. And yet I feel I had a very close collaboration with both Ren and David. Now, this was unheard of in the days of the Hindenburg. I mean, the days of the movie of the Hindenburg.
Right.
So I'd say that was the biggest difference, because tone is, you know, can change. But mm-hmm. I can't imagine going back to the old way now of, you know, running into the studio and asking the music editor to show me a few reels. Now I have the picture in my studio. I work right to it. They wanted synth demos of every cue, David and Ren, as good as we could make them sound orchestrally. So when Bob Wise heard the orchestrations for the Hindenburg for the first time, we were on the scoring stage. If there had been a misconception, which luckily there wasn't, it would have been very expensive. In contradistinction to that, on Zodiac, by the time we went in with the orchestra, we had worked out every detail. I had rewritten cues, many cues, several times. So all of the conceptual stuff was done. We could work on little details like dynamics and relative volume and things like that, which often you never have a chance to get to because recording sessions are so busy with rewriting stuff that the director suddenly isn't happy with.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Hindenburg is a brilliant score. Very, very happy that it got re-released.
Me too.
So
I hear Short Circuit might get. Varese is either Varese or Entrada working on that. Now that the studios are becoming more generous, maybe you'll see more of my stuff out there.
Well, that would be another one that I would very much look forward to, and I'm sure many other people would as well.
Yeah, I'm fond of that one.
So now, do you see soundtrack music becoming the classical music of tomorrow? Will the names of Goldsmith, Shire, be remembered?
I think it will remain film music that's done in pop concerts. I've started to do pop concerts. I just did one in Buffalo a couple of weeks ago with the Buffalo Philharmonic, conducting a whole evening of my film and theater music.
Mm-hmm.
And it was lovely, but, you know, it doesn't belong on the regular symphony program next to Mahler and Beethoven. I think it's a lovely niche, not market, but niche, one of the subdivisions of music. It's hard to say whether it's serious, quote-unquote serious music or unserious, because some scores are more serious than others.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain cues probably in some of my work, and certainly in Johnny Williams' work and Jerry Goldsmith's, which can hold their own right next to, you know, the masters, but it wasn't written for that purpose. Certainly a suite, a well-constructed suite from a terrific score is concert-worthy, but generally in programming, the classical people keep the classical concerts separate from the so-called pop concerts or film music concerts, but that's okay. You know, they're overlapping audiences, but I think they're different audiences. There's some people who love Beethoven who loathe film music, and there's some people who love film music who love Beethoven, like I'm one of them. I don't think you can make an easy statement about that.
So is there any composers that you know of that have just started recently that have kind of caught your attention?
I love the work lately of Alexander Desplat.
Ah, yes.
I have always loved Tommy Newman's work. Tommy Newman, I probably feel more. I've never met him. I wrote him a fan letter once. But I feel more spiritually akin to him, in terms of aesthetically akin to him, than just about anybody. I guess mainly because every picture he does, he creates a specific sound for. You feel like he's scoring that movie and no other movie. He's not pulling any tricks out of his bag. The music's always intelligent and interesting in itself, and it always serves the drama beautifully, which is, I guess, what my watchwords are.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to meet him sometime.
Cool.
And, of course, Johnny Williams is head and shoulders above most of us. I mean, he can do anything. He's probably known for fewer things than he can do. You know, he can write remarkable music in mm-hmm. just about any style, but the broad public knows him for the big, you know, the Star Wars scores, and prior to that for the disaster scores. But, you know, his chamber scores are just as thrilling. You know, I left out Bernard Herrmann. He's been an inspiration. And my inspiration for Zodiac was both a Charles Ives piece called The Unanswered Question.
Oh, yes.
And working with a string orchestra and creating tension music, you can't avoid Bernard Herrmann.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some homage to him there, too. You know, when you asked me that previous question, I forgot to say that rather than that, the connection between classical music and
yes.
film music is very interesting, because film music, you know, coming later than the invention, so to speak, of classical music, has always drawn on classical music for its inspiration. And generally, you can, especially with the early film masters, well, that famous speech of Dmitri Tiomkin, where he won the Academy Award, and
mm-hmm.
said, "I'd like to thank Tchaikovsky, I'd like to thank Beethoven, I'd like to, you know," down the list. But that's true, and that's the way it should be. And yet, I've heard scores that develop techniques that feed that could inspire maybe a classical composer. There's a lot of very inventive, original music written for film. Mm-hmm. Not a lot. I shouldn't say a lot. Less and less, maybe. but some. And that cross-pollination is healthy. I mean, I learned 12-tone music and thought I would never want to write a piece mm-hmm. of it for a concert. Knew I wasn't going into a concert career, so I thought, well, this is interesting, but what will I ever use it for? And Pelham has become one of my signature scores, and it employed, I finally solved the problem after a month of groping to get the sound for that picture with 12-tone techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And in Zodiac, I've used some of those same techniques again.
Is there anything else in your future?
I'm servicing right now my theater career
mm-hmm.
and that concert career. I have some other gigs coming up. And also, I shouldn't say also, that's the also. Mainly I'm working on our latest musical project, which is an original musical called Take Flight, which has its tryout in London this summer
mm-hmm.
at a theater there, and then in Japan in November. So I'm busy with writing the final few numbers for that, and then I have to orchestrate the whole thing. Working on a TV project with my wife, Didi Khan, a children's animated musical television series that we're making a pilot for, which involves a bunch of songs which I've written, both music and lyrics, and another smaller show that just played in Ventura, tried out there, and is moving to Buffalo for a couple of months, and we have to write a few more songs for that, and a chamber opera commission, one-act chamber opera for the Colorado Children's Chorale, which is due a year from April. So I got plenty to do, and yet the phone could ring any time, and hopefully it be David Fincher or somebody else like him asking if I'm available to do a score.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that work, too.
Right. Well, I just want to say thank you for the scores that you've given us over the years. And hopefully there'll be some fantastic stuff. I'm really looking forward to Zodiac.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure.
Same here.
Yes, it was a great pleasure to speak to David Shire, and hopefully I'll get a chance to speak to him in the future. I'm looking to actually follow up with a lot more of his scores. Of course, recently, just this year actually, he released the score to Zodiac, and that's on Varese Saraband. But if you are looking for the score to Hindenburg, you can find it on the label, the Entrada label, and that's available at entrada.com. And it's limited to a release of 3,000 copies. I have one here, and there are others out there, but pick one up and grab it, especially if you enjoy this score, which is, like I said, it's a fantastic score. So I'm going to get to more of that score. But before I do, if you are interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on Visions and Sound, you can contact me here at the station at 884-CKMS. That's 884-2567. Or you can try me online at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. So here is some more of David Shire's score to The Hindenburg.
there's a new voice sweeping the fatherland. Loyal Germans understand. As they rally round, it's exciting sound how their hearts expand. There's a new voice keeping the fatherland to its ancient noble vow. Helping restless men start to build again, showing where and how. There's a lot to be said for the Fuhrer. Why, I hardly know where to begin. For our pride in Aryan purity, security, thank Berlin. All the bold, youthful steps he is taking make you feel like something special's in the air. What has got to be said for the Fuhrer is, who else would ever dare?
Who else is making opportunities for busy pioneers in occupation? And proudly staking new communities to permanent careers in concentration.
If you simply adore Mussolini, but you're tired of his tendency to yell, there's a lot to be said for the Fuhrer, and he says it all so well. There's a lot to be said for the Nazis. They are bringing the press into line. They have modernized the cinema, the radio, and the Rhine.
It's a simply spectacular party, and a failure to attend would be a crime.
There's a lot to be said for the Nazis, and I hope it's said in time.
And with just a little bit of more music from the film The Hindenburg, that's music by David Shire, and that last little bit performed by Peter Donat and, who's the other guy? Oh, Robert Clay, yes. Robert Clay, like I said, is best known for his work as LeBeau in the TV series Hogan's Heroes. So if you're interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on Visions and Sound, you can contact me here at the station at 884-CKMS. That's 884-2567. Or you can try me online at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. Well, Hindenburg was directed by Robert Wise, and Robert Wise was born the youngest of three brothers, through an odd job at RKO at the age of 19, he came into the film business. A sound effects editor at the studio recognized Wise's talent and made Wise his protege. Around 1941, Orson Welles was in need of an editor for Citizen Kane, and Wise did a splendid job. In fact, Welles speaks very, very highly of Wise's work on that film. Now, Wise started as a director with some B-movies, and his career went quickly. He made very many classic movies, including The Sound of Music, West Side Story, The Day the Earth Stood Still, The Andromeda Strain, and Star Trek The Motion Picture. Robert Wise passed away in 2005. Now, George C. Scott, main lead in this film, was an immensely talented actor who was born in Virginia in 1927. It was in the late 50s where he landed a role in Richard III in New York City. The play was a hit and brought Scott to the attention of the critics. Soon, he began to get work in television, and in 1959, he landed the part of the crafty prosecutor in Anatomy of a Murder. It is this role that got him his first Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor. Now, one of Scott's best-known characters, General Buck Turgidson from Stanley Kubrick's Our comical anti-war film, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, from 1964. It became one of his favorites, and he often said that he felt guilty for getting paid for it, as he was having so much fun. Years would pass before he got a role which he will always be identified with, that being General Patton from 1970. The actor's portrayal of this aggressive military icon drew sympathy for the controversial hero. He won the Oscar this time, but stayed home to watch hockey instead. Scott continued to make films throughout the 70s and 80s, including The Changeling from 1980, Taps from 1981, 1984's Firestarter, and the TV movie The 12 Angry Men from 1997. That's just to name a few. George C. Scott passed away on September 22nd, 1999. Now, Anne Bancroft was born in 1931 in the Bronx, New York, and she made her cinema debut in the 1952 film Don't Bother to Knock. In the 50s, she made a lot of movies as supporting actress, thus she became a star with The Miracle Worker in 1962, for which she won an Academy Award. The 60s, in general, were her best years. The Pumpkin Eater from 1964, directed by Jack Clayton. Seven Women from 1966. And The Graduate from 1967. In 1964, she married Mel Brooks. After the 60s, she reduced her appearances in movies, but appeared in several films, including several well-known films, rather, including Point of No Return, Honeymoon in Vegas, Great Expectations, Ants, and even though she passed away in 2005, her voice will live on for one final performance in a CGI film scheduled for this year called Delgo. Well, a little extra something here. Hindenburg did win two achievements in Oscars, one for sound effects and the other for visual effects. Well, getting close to the end of the program, but I just wanted to say that if you are interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on Visions and Sound, you can contact me here at the station at 884-CKMS. That's 884-2567. You can also try me online at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. I'll be happy to provide you with a track listing of today's program, even some information as to where you can find this particular CD. Although if you are interested, it is limited to a release of 3,000 and can be found on the Intrada website. So what I will do is I will continue on with some more music from the Hindenburg.
Thank you. practically standing still. Now they've got ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. It's starting to rain again. The rain had slacked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from...
It bursts into flame. It bursts into flame and it's falling. It's crashing. Watch it. It's crashing. Terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning and bursting into flames and it's falling on the mooring fast and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's inflation. 400 or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the passengers screaming around me. I can't even talk to people whose friends are on there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. I can't. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost the voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed.
And with some music from the 1975 film, including that very horrific sounding Herb Morrison, and the excerpt from his broadcast at the airfield where the Hindenburg crashed. What exactly happened to the Hindenburg has always remained a mystery. Some people think it was in fact sabotaged, while others in fact think that it was a simple accident of static electricity, while others think that the fact that filling a huge cigar-shaped airship full of a flammable gas was not the greatest of ideas. Others also think that the skin of the ship was painted with some sort of a paint that actually caused it actually created a substance called thermite, which caused the ship to explode essentially and burn. And like I said, if you've seen the episode of MythBusters where they actually show the Hindenburg disaster and what happens, you kind of get the idea that that some of that may have been the case, and that hydrogen and the fact of filling it with hydrogen and the paint that they used on the Hindenburg itself caused the whole flame, the whole explosion. Anyway, that's for historians and not myself to make the final decision on as to exactly what happened to the Hindenburg. While the Hindenburg is not available in stores, if you are looking for the score, you can go on to Entrada.com and order it from their website there. And you can also find it at other places as well, buysoundtracks.com, that kind of thing. Anyway, so if you are interested in picking that up, like I said, go on to Entrada.com. A couple of people I'd like to thank here today, David Shire being one of them. It was fantastic to speak to him, and he was able to send me a copy of the Hindenburg score. Fantastic stuff. And I highly, highly recommend it to those that are looking for this score from the 70s. Fantastic stuff. Anyway, that's it for me, and I hope you've enjoyed this look at the score to the 1975 film Hindenburg. I'll end off this week with a special presentation of the main title. Now, this was as originally as David Shire had composed it, with the soprano being heard in the in this mix instead of the trumpet. So now you'll actually hear it as it was originally supposed to be presented in the film. So this particular piece is actually from a release called The Disasters Movie Music Album by Silva America. So enjoy it, and I'll be back next week with more Visions in Sound.